Hello, this is the Schwepp. And we are delighted today to welcome back Jason Ananda Josephson Storm, Jason Storm for short, to talk about James George Frazer. A man who has more to tell us about Western esotericism in the modern period than I thought, and that many people think. So first of all, Jason, it's a delight to welcome you back for the third time to the Schwepp.
Yeah.
That might be some kind of record. Maybe not. At least you're tied with, I don't think anyone's ever done four Schweppes, and couldn't be happier to see you. Now, the reason we are doing this episode is because keen listener and friend of the podcast, Pete McLaughlin, got in touch with me a while back. He had listened to my episode 5, Methodologies for the Study of Magic, in which I incautiously said, I said, Frazer is Englishman. No, he was not. He was Scottish. That makes a big difference. And he said, come on, he's not English. I said, okay, I got that wrong. That's just a mistake. But he also pointed out that the sort of potted history we get of Frazer is often something along these lines. I'm going to give you the caricature version, but it's a version that lives in a lot of people's heads. In the 19th century, at the height of rationalist materialism, Victorian era, a few people, sort of folklorists or comparative religion scholars, set out to kind of debunk the notion of magic. And among the highlights always mentioned are Tyler and Frazer. And what Frazer and Tyler did is construct ideas of magic, religion, and science as separate things, interrelated but separate, and that magic is basically dying out in the modern world, giving way to either A, just science, or B, religion plus science, like an enlightened, scientifically informed religion going forward. And that's where we find ourselves. And what McLaughlin pointed out to me is actually Frazer's relationship with these concepts, religion, science, and magic, is much more fraught and interesting than you let on in your episode. And he can maybe profitably be seen as part of Western esotericism in the 19th century, early 20th century. And it happens that you have written a bit about this and agreed to come on. So before we get into it, who was James George Frazer?
Sure. Yeah. So first, I want to say it's a real pleasure to be back on here. One of my favorite podcasts. So it's always good to chat with you.
Top man.
So James George Frazer was born in 1854 in Glasgow, Scotland. His father was a pharmacist who was a partner in a firm called Frazer and Green. And his dad was also a devout member of the Free Church of Scotland. So Frazer grew up in this context. He's very sort of suburban, middle class, basically equivalent in a fully industrialized Glasgow. He studied at the University of Glasgow for the equivalent of his master's. And then he went on to Trinity College, Cambridge, where he ended up doing classics, and he actually did his dissertation on Plato. It was later published in the 30s as The Growth of Plato's Ideal Theory, where it's about the Platonic doctrine of the forms. And so he starts as a classicist. Almost his entire professional career, except for 1 year where he's in Liverpool, he was at Trinity College, Cambridge, and he was a research associate, basically. He was he got the kind of job you get right after you graduate, but you haven't got a full lectureship, and then he stuck with it. So he's not teaching, he's just in the library, and he's writing and researching like crazy. The only other key coordinates in his life that are worth mentioning at this point are that he married a woman named Lily Grove. She was born Elizabeth Adelsdorfer in the Alsace, so she was Francophone. And he died he lived quite a long time. He died in 1941. He lived through a period where he was huge and famous and even was knighted, and then through a later period where he was increasingly irrelevant, basically, or at least not taken as seriously. The other thing to know about Fraser, I guess, is his most important work, which I'm sure we're going to talk about in detail, is The Golden Bough, originally subtitled A Study in Comparative Religion, when it was published in 1890, and then resubtitled A Study in Magic and Religion, where we get into our frame, when it was published in its second edition in 1900, and then it went in three volumes, and then he expanded it to an insane 12 volumes in a set of third editions over 1906 to 1915, and then he was still working on yet another fourth edition, which came out as The Afterlife of the Golden Bough in 1925. He was late in life, he actually went blind, and some other things that made him, or starting to go blind, that made it harder for him to continue working on it, but it was his obsession. So that's our intro into Fraser. Okay, I could keep riffing, but I'll let you ask. Yeah,
next. Let me just add, it has become almost de rigueur in scholarly fields like history of religions, anthropology, etc., to diss Fraser, right? So he's yeah, on a number of methodological grounds, like, for example, his idea that all humans everywhere have some kind of primordial dying and resurrection, fertility, god, marrying an earth goddess thing that is central to the way they think. Or at least that used to be the case before science came along. That's just been questioned. Like, do they really all have that? And a bunch of other things have been questioned about his work. So it's almost like you have to diss Fraser. If you mention him, you have to at least like diss him while you mention him.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's read, broadly speaking, quite negatively. In the history of discipline, he's a footnote. As you said, he's often described as part of a rationalist school that, and we'll debunk this in a few minutes, but that stripped away, you know, notions of the rejected magic, that he had a militant comparativism, which people think was insane. He was also very much an armchair anthropologist, insofar as that's fair to describe him. He wasn't exactly an anthropologist, but he's there at the birth of anthropology and folklore when those are entwined disciplines. Much more of a folklorist, really, than an anthropologist. But in any case, he while he traveled to, like, he had one or two trips to, like, Italy and Greece, he never met any indigenous people, basically. But he did this massive comparative stuff where he'd obsessively, you know, identify some myth and then say, oh, and there's a similar version among the Cherokee, among the Bantu, among the, you know, Philippine Islanders, something, in some way that we now completely debunk. But that said, although he's been disavowed in the discipline, he had a long afterlife that we'll discuss, Nachleben, in esoteric circles, in literary circles. He continues to inspire new art and music. There's like the Doors refer to him in a song. This isn't new, but, you know, like, and he's the inspiration behind basically contemporary genre of folk horror, I would say. I see Fraser behind a whole genre of things like The Wicker Man, which keeps being remade, you know, and versions, Midsummer, you know, like there's this whole kind of background there in which he is a central figure, and he isn't exactly the caricature. And we can go into some more detail what he wrote in The Golden Bough and why it was important. And then it's also worth flagging at the outset that he made a significant shift in his arguments between the first and second edition of The Golden Bough. And I think that's something where, from my perspective, other scholars, there are a couple exceptions, but have been too inattentive. So they tend to presume that he had the basic same architecture. And actually, there's a big break between the first and second editions, which we could talk about precisely around the issues that listeners to this podcast are going to be interested. So should I start by talking about The Golden Bough and what its argument was, or
why not?
Something
Let
else?
Let me just recapitulate. First edition, two volumes, 1890. Second edition, expanded to three volumes, 1900, and now it's got a new subtitle. And then third edition, weighing in at 12 volumes, 1906 to 1915. This is just laying on the scholarship with a trowel. And then you get these various abridged editions, some of which may or may not have been kind of like tampered with by his wife.
Yes. That's right. So yeah, right, exactly. They have been. And so don't assume that reading the abridged edition, you're getting the real narrative. It's cleaned up.
Yeah.
And so just let that be. I mean, it's bonkers, and to read the whole thing can be kind of like a weird associative fever dream or something. But do read the full editions, especially if you want to comment on Fraser. I think that's where some of the interpretive mess comes from, which is people reading the abridged edition and assuming that they've got the essence of the text, and really they don't.
Okay. Can you characterize, maybe the best way about going about diving into the Golden Bough would be if you could give a characterization of the first edition, 1890, in some ways being written in a different world than, in a way, than 10 years later, the second edition.
Yeah.
So what's the first book about? What's its kind of theme? And then what changes when the second edition comes out?
Yeah, so the first edition, so the departure point for the entire thing is Fraser was working on a translation of Pausanias's description of Greece. And in that context, he came across a reference that Pausanias made to something called the Rex Nemerensis. In other words, the story of a particular priest of Diana in a place called Nemi in contemporary Italy, who the story goes... held his office by killing the predecessor in single combat. He's like usually a freed slave or an escaped slave, according to the narrative, who like would become king of the grove if only he could kill his predecessor. And crucially, before engaging in that fight, the contender had to prove his worth by snatching a golden bough from a tree in a sacred grove. So Pausanias, and as far as we can reconstruct, many of his contemporaries thought this was weird. This is not like the archetype of Roman pre-Christian religion. But from Fraser's perspective, he decides that this is the interpretive key in the first edition to Arian religion more broadly, and then later in the second edition and subsequent editions to religion, or actually to pre-religion, to magic as such. But in the first edition, partially, Fraser is in dialogue with other folklorists. He's less exceptional in this regard than he's sometimes portrayed. Many of his contemporary folklorists, already starting, you know, basically from early in the 19th century, when folklore is just sort of becoming to define itself as a subfield, had been interested in the preservation of what they called survivals. The basic idea is that the contemporary peasants of somewhere are preserving these older traditions. One of them, you know, that we know Fraser read, for instance, this is a little later, but a guy named James Ferrer in Primitive Manners and Customs of 1879 said, quote, "The mass of purely pagan ideas, which varnished over by Christianity, but barely hidden by it, grow in rank profusion in our very midst and exercise a living hold," end quote. And he's talking about the English countryside. So the idea is the peasants are pagans. And for Fraser, he begins the first edition of the Golden Bough with this grove at Nemi, and he signals the church bells, ringing of the Catholic Church. And you can hear him saying, basically, the contemporary Catholic... There's a Protestant anti-Catholicism here, basically, that's going on. There's also a kind of suspicion of rural working class folks, or whatever we want to call them. And from Fraser's perspective, he imagines that it's basically the same thing that has been going on throughout the course of Italian history, with the peasants sacrificing to or engaging in rituals to a vegetal god, a god that in certain significant respects represents the agricultural seasons. We can see how it fits into the rhythm of peasant life. You cut down the corn is dead, you plant the corn comes back to life. These classic cycles Fraser sees as at the root of a peasant religion and at the root of both, and he's quite clear about this. He means this to be implied in the first edition between paganism and Christianity. And so, or what he thinks of as paganism and Christianity. And he's influenced also, I should say, by German scholarship, in particular, a work by Wilhelm Mannhardt, Mannhardt's Wald- und Feldkult, which is also has vegetal gods in it.
Right.
But for Fraser, this idea is that there are, that there's this primordial god of the agricultural cycles, which is what is behind both the kingship in this particular grove and what he originally thinks of as Arian religion more broadly. And for him, as he makes it very implicit, and this is here also in a letter to his publisher about the first edition, he wants it to be read between the lines that Christianity is just a thin Semitic veneer on an Arian religious formulation, which is about this a rural or agricultural god. You know, it changes in later editions, but that's kind of what he's for the first edition of that work.
So although he does have the traditional Protestant anti-Catholic bent you might expect from a son of the Kirk, that it, you know, Catholicism pretends to be Christianity, but it's really just magic, or it's full of magic or whatever. He also seems to be more than willing to historicize Jesus and Christianity as a product of this same kind of vegetal cult with a few changes that have been made, which is a very radical position. It takes you sort of outside of traditional. This is like in line with what Darwin is doing, in line with what is going on with the quest for the historical Jesus in German, which I can't remember the author off the top of my head. Like all this sort of very searching critique of Christianity from within the Christian world, going like, I don't think any of this stuff is necessarily historical, right? So that's an interesting position to be taking, a very kind of like dangerous position.
Yeah, and he's also reacting to people like Max Müller, who had argued that behind mythology was a kind of solar cult. So for Müller, you know, the famously myth is a quote-unquote disease of language. And for Müller, Aryan religion in particular, Indo-European religion in particular, is basically primitive. Indo-Europeans aren't really able to talk well about astrology or solar cycles, and so they come up with names like Deus or Deus Pater to describe like the sun, and then they somehow get caught in a myth cycle. So Frazier is also trying to intervene in that. He's desolarizing it in a certain way.
Right.
He's connecting it up to the lives of peasants, and crucially, in the first edition of the work, he doesn't distinguish magic and religion. And that is a huge shift in the second edition. But in the first edition, there's a blurring of lines. Primitive religion has some magical elements to it, etc. But it's not yet a distinct analytical category. Religion and magic are not yet distinct analytical categories.
Yep. Let's talk about the second edition then. Expanded and with a new subtitle.
Yep, which the new subtitle brings magic into the top line, and he starts to differentiate magic and religion, and he starts to put them in a chronological evolutionary trajectory, which is super important. So, but it has a wrinkle in it. And so I wanted to read to you in an interview with Frazier that's published in 1940 by the only biography that authorized of him, written during his life by R. Angus Downey. Frazier described the essence of the Golden Bough as follows, quote, "The cycle of the Golden Bough depicts, in its sinuous outline, in its play of alternate light and shadow, the long evolution by which the thoughts and efforts of man have passed through the successive stages of magic, religion, and science." But then he goes on. Here's what he says. "It is in some measure an epic of humanity, which starting from magic, attains to science in its ripe age, and will find there, perhaps, its death. For the monster which has created human thought today threatens to annihilate the very race which depends upon it for its progress and well-being," end quote.
Whoa.
So there's a plot twist at the end. So anyway, yeah, which we could talk a little bit more about, but
and,
yes.
And that's what, like 5 years before the first atomic bomb is dropped or something like that.
Yes, indeed. Boom. Indeed. Yeah.
No pun intended.
So here's some key pieces, too, that I want to emphasize. In the first instance, magic comes up as a central interpretive category in the second edition. Magic is no longer religion. And crucially, magic for Frazier is more like science than it is like religion.
Yeah.
He repeatedly describes magic as basically, well, he says, let me find a quote that I have here. Quote, "The fundamental conception of magic is identical to that of modern science," end quote. And then he says, quote, "All magic is necessarily false and barren, for were to ever become true and fruitful, it would no longer be magic, but science," end quote. Basically, science is magic that works.
Yeah.
Magic is just the science that doesn't work. And religion is the exception. And he also thinks that early magic believes that the world is full of regular events described by, quote, immutable laws, end quote. And so, like, he doesn't think of anybody who studies magic. He doesn't think that, like, spirits or angelic magic or demonic magic is magic. Ur magic for him is basically ritual practice designed to recapitulate or compel things like rain or fertility or agricultural cycles. And he thinks that magic precedes religion, but magic is also, for him, the common sense thinking of the ordinary human. Like, humans ordinarily think in terms of magic. Science is the common sense bits, but with the parts that work clarified. So there's a commonsensicality. And later generations of scholars, and this is why people often misread, for instance, Max Weber, who is very influenced by Frazier. Weber thinks of magic as instrumentally rational. It's not irrational in Weber. And for Frazier, it is too. Magic has a kind of rationality to it. It's hard to falsify, he thinks. That's part of why it persists. Etc. But the other, so part of it is that connection. The other key thing that I want to emphasize too, that Frazier is doing in a particularly innovative way, and we can return to his theories of magic in a minute, but is that he sees behind myth a kind of notion of ritual. So he's kind of engaged in a kind of project of, you know, we said this in our emails, but an esoteric exegesis of myth. There is a truth behind myth. And the truth behind myth, it's not the initiation into the mystery cults, but it is a ritual practice. And the ritual practice, he thinks of these original rituals as more bloody and more violent. He's interested in fertility goddesses, sex rites, human sacrifice, and dying and reborn gods, which he decides by the second edition were universal everywhere. He's done some reading of the indigenous peoples of Australia, and he's decided that they fit this pattern, that totemism is magic, not religion, and that it's involved in a totemic rite that involves a sacrifice of the totemic animal. He will be, again, an influence also on Freud. So you'll see Freud cites him extensively in Totem and Taboo. Again, this idea is that it's like this universal pattern or nearly universal agricultural pattern.
All right. Now we've seen a very fateful, as it turns out, change in his thinking, right? Between these two editions. Yeah. He's suddenly invented this thing called magic. He's given it a definition. It's basically, to paraphrase him, something like an appreciation that the universe operates on cause and effect. You can't always see the causes, so you might need to get involved in like the unseen causes, the occult causes, and that's where powerful rituals come in. And that's also what science does. Science just does it better, more effectively, more rigorously, with better correction for falsifiability and all that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Which is a fascinating take to put forward. It's a take that listeners to the podcast who've really come up on a diet of what you might call post-Crowleyan thinking about magic, because I think Crowley really put his stamp on the way certain discourses talk about magic and conceive of it, we'll just think, yeah, obviously, or, you know, something along those lines. Like, this doesn't seem that revolutionary or anything like that, but it actually is. It's totally out of the blue, right? In a certain way. He's been thinking
hard. It's pretty out of the blue. Yeah. I mean, there are echoes of it in other sources, you know, like Auguste Comte has some gestures that might be read plausibly that way. Frazier will later be introduced to a passage in Hegel that he thinks resonates with his particular version of a chronological narrative. But basically, he is innovative, and he's also innovative, which I shouldn't forget, in characterizing magic in terms of two fundamental principles, the law of similarity and the law of contagion. So, you know, from the first, you know, he says, quote, the magician infers that he can produce any effect he desires merely by imitating it. And from the second, he infers that whatever he does to a material object will affect equally the person with whom the object was once in contact, end quote. And so he gets this similarity and contagion. And then the other piece that I want to note in terms of the chronology, and listeners who hear this on your oddcast will dig this, I was trying to figure out, like, how did he come to this changing view? And there are a couple of different possible influences. One of them is a thinker named Jevons, who also differentiates magic and religion. Another is his renewed reading on Australian, quote-unquote, Aboriginal cultures. But another is that he gets attention called to fairy belief in the period. And I get this because I actually went to the archive in Trinity where he was hanging out, and there's a clipping that he made from... I think it's from the Nationalist Tipperary Advertiser, which ran an article in 1895, quote, the mysterious disappearance of a young woman, the land of the banshee and the fairy, end quote, which refers to this woman from Clonmel in Ireland named Bridget Cleary, who was basically killed by a family member who had come to believe that she was a changeling. Mm. That's the short version of it. But for Frazier, this gave him a kind of fear that, you know, that the primitive peoples could reinvent human sacrifice at any moment. And This for him wasn't a religious practice. This was a ritual act to kill, because the idea was that she'd been beaten. Her husband thought that she was a changeling and he was going to beat her until she confessed that she was really a fairy. So for Frasier, and she dies sadly, but and for Frasier, this is also similar to the burning of a witch. This is also this human sacrifice. This is an attempt to identify this other kind of a being. It's fundamentally like an eruption from the primordial past. And then the other thing that I talk about in some detail in my chapter is that there's this fairy folkloric trope, which is the departure of the fairies, the fairy farewell. Mm. So when he starts doing research on fairies, he couldn't help but come across the idea that the fairies are always departing and are always vanishing. And that in a way, there's an early version of a notion of disenchantment in the folkloric world itself. And we talked about this in our interview a dog's age ago, so I'll point your listeners back to that. But all that is to say, it's a little bit overdetermined that he would begin to think of his magic as vanishing. So not only do I have this document, does he preserve newspaper clippings in his archive, but then he refers to it himself in an edition of the Golden Bough. I forget whether it's in the second or third, but anyway, he refers to Bridget Cleary. Mm. So we know he read the work and he cites it. But the other key oddity about Frasier that are... early schema, the early quote from him may have suggested, is that he also didn't think science was the end. So this is the other way that we may want to push back against the cliched version of the thumbnail of Frasier. He described himself as an agnostic, and he at various points said, you know, he didn't think of himself as a Christian, and there is a kind of anti-Christian language that he meant to be, he meant people to use the Golden Bough for. But he also was skeptical about certain views of science. And in particular, we have this from his letters, and we have this from a later work of his called The Worship of Nature, which he thinks that science involves a continual effort of simplification, and that behind science is an attempt to turn disorder into order. He sees parallel movement in religion and science, actually. He describes a despiritualization of nature. He's citing Schiller's Entgottete Natur, but degotted nature, but it's almost like a disenchantment narrative. But he thinks science, too, tries to strip out entities and strip out entities and strip out entities. Both of them converge on, in a spiritual world, he thinks, a unique notion of God, and in a scientific world, a unique notion of matter. But, and he says this repeatedly in a bunch of places, those are both leading toward oversimplifications. As he puts it in, let me see if I can bring it up, The Worship of Nature, science has recently been at work to simplify the ultimate problems by reducing the seemingly irreducible principles of space and time to a single reality. It is not for me to pronounce an opinion on this bold generalization, but I refer to it only as perhaps the latest effort of the philosophic or scientific mind to unify and harmonize the apparently heterogeneous and discordant constituents of the universe. Later, he suggests elsewhere, and this is in another text, we must remember that at bottom, the generalizations of in science, or in common parlance, the laws of nature, are merely hypotheses devised to explain the ever-shifting phantasmagoria of thought. In last analysis, magic, religion, and science are nothing but theories of thought, and as science has supplanted its predecessors, so it may hereafter be itself superseded by some more perfect hypothesis, perhaps by some totally different way of looking at the phenomena of registering the shadows on the screen, end quote.
Boom. Call back to Plato's cave.
Yes.
I love it. Now, this guy is, whatever else he's doing, he's thinking hard about it. So he's responding to Einstein here, right? With this idea that maybe space and time are the same thing, like what? Which everyone in the 20s and 30s is responding to. But he's also looking beyond the triumphal Victorian materialist universe that he grew up in, which is now old hat because of Einstein and people like that, and saying, well, what's the next thing going to be? Maybe my tripartite magic, religion, science isn't the whole story. It's not. It's much less triumphalist than you might expect from a knighted academic of the height of the Victorian era, you know?
Yeah, and I see that at work in the third edition. So like in the first edition, he hasn't yet got to his schema. In the second edition, he's got the hard, the almost the cliched version of the three. Yeah. And then by the third edition, and then in other works that he's doing after the second edition and before the third edition comes out, or while the third edition is coming out, he starts to think about its limits. And so he is an evolving thinker. And I think that's, you know, we have to give him credit for that, even though, yeah, his comparativism was insane and his basic stuff is, you know, very easy to criticize, but he's not the cliche, and he is very aware of the limits of science and what he thinks of as what's going to come past science. Like
love
it's
it.
Yeah,
love it.
Yeah.
So that is a pretty beautiful picture of the Golden Bough. We haven't talked so much about its significance, but I think you can say that, especially in sort of the 1920s or the noughts of the teens and the 20s of the 20th century, the Golden Bough is like on a short list of books that blew everyone's mind. And I'm not talking about academics, I'm talking about the general public, but especially creative people, especially, for example, the modernists. So Eliot, Robert Graves, Ezra Pound, Aleister Crowley, yeah. Which, you know, I kind of feel like maybe he can be considered a modernist in some way. They're all reading Fraser and going whole hog. Oswald Spengler is another one of these books that sort of had its moment, blew everyone's mind, and then was quickly debunked and forgotten about by serious thinkers in the same field that he was working in, but went on to, you know, have really big echoes in 20th century thought. Before we get to the specific echoes of Fraser in Western esotericism, which are crucially important, what's kind of the general vibe of the influence of Fraser's work on the 20th century and 21st century?
Yeah, I mean, so definitely. So he's a big influence on creative, I would say modernist work in the decades that follow him. You know, we have references to him in T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. He's in Graves. He's in James Joyce. He even one of my favorites, H.P. Lovecraft, throws a call out it might be in The Call of Cthulhu, anyway, Lovecraft has a reference.
I was thinking of Lovecraft. So, sorry, I have to do a little Lovecraft side note here, because it's exactly Lovecraft. On the one hand, fear of atavism, like the fear that if we don't try hard enough as a civilization, the most dark primordial soup can just come to the surface, as it does among peasants in Lovecraft. It's always like sort of New England hillbillies, right? But also, on the other side of science lies madness. Right? Like you get to this place where science ends and there's this hyper science where human minds just explode. It's like a dark Fraserian worldview.
Yeah, totally. And even other folks in the horror literature, like Ted Klein, I forget, The Ceremonies, that's basically like a Fraserian novel. If those of you, I love horror literature, so if those of you who are listeners who are interested, check that one out. I don't want to spoil it, but it's basically one of the characters is reconstructing different fragments of myth and ritual to piece together a living magic tradition. And that's actually, we don't need Klein to do, because that's also what Crowley does too, because Crowley references the Golden Bough extensively. Fraser is also an influence on, and we'll go into this in more detail, but on Wiccanism, particularly the notion of fertility rituals and fertility goddesses. He also influences, as I mentioned earlier, Sigmund Freud. Wittgenstein even has a commentary on the Golden Bough. So, I mean, the text is just all over the place. Yeah, and folks were getting different things out of it.
Right.
Some of them were getting this notion of the potential, you know, rupture of atavism or whatever. Some folks were getting out of it a historical arc that would leave religion in the past. It becomes a kind of disenchantment narrative. Some folks were getting out of it the idea of particularly this radical notion of dying and reborn gods. The idea that the Christian narrative in particular, but also people are assimilating it to Osiris and what have you, and to a whole host of other figures that Fraser details in a lot of detail, that these are all versions of the same myth, that there's a kind of universal myth form. Other folks are getting from it the idea that magic is fundamental to ordinary thinking. And so, you know, you get this de-alienated, like it's a revival of natural magic notions, kind of in a way. But the idea that primitive peoples across the globe tend to think in magic ways, and that those magic ways are irrespective of their particular their particular mythologies or, you know, belief systems, but also the style is influential. Like, he writes in this Baroque, over the top kind of way, and it has like this insane movement. Like, he goes from anecdote to anecdote to anecdote to anecdote in a kind of wandering meander that you could almost think of like an influence on James Joyce in a stylistic way. It's like a stream of thought.
Yeah. Let's turn to the final thing we really need to talk about, which is the reception of Fraser in Western esotericism specifically. And I think there's at least two things we want to talk about. Crowley on the one hand, and maybe his Crowley and his colleagues, and the sort of neo-pagan side of things. Crowley somewhere, I think it's one of the appendices to Magic in Theory and Practice, which he didn't actually publish as such, I think, but was published at some point. It's a collection of his writings. I think he has a sort of reading list for aspiring occultists or aspiring magicians. And one of the works on there is The Golden Bough of Fraser.
Yeah, I mean, even more than that. So, like, Crowley actually matriculated at Trinity College, Cambridge, while Fraser was there. So they overlapped at the same college. Fraser wasn't lecturing, but it's clear that Fraser... I mean, sorry, yeah, Fraser wasn't lecturing then, but it's clear that Crowley knew that Fraser was there. He read The Golden Bough then. Early references to The Golden Bough are in his Juvenalia. He wrote a play. Crowley wrote, like, this play. I talk about it in my chapter, but it's... inspired, called The God Eater, which is a play about the origin of religion. It's titled, quote, or described as, quote, a play in which the origin of religion is conceived by Spencer or Fraser is dramatically shown forth, end quote. So, I mean, it's there, and there are references to The Golden Bough in many places in Crowley's work. I give the full sources in my chapter. They're not fully in my memory, but they're quite extensive. And especially when Crowley is beginning to think about magical practices, he's looking at rituals that he's trying to reconstruct from The Golden Bough. It's kind of almost like a proto spell book for him. It's also important for him when he makes the case that science and magic are fundamentally the same, except he takes the view that instead of magic being backward science, it's cutting edge science.
Right.
So he even references Fraser to justify that at one point. We wouldn't have Crowley the way that we have Crowley without Fraser. I mean, it's just, there's a clear line directly there.
Mm.
And then from Crowley, it spreads, you know, hugely, you know, you'll do multiple episodes on Crowley, I'm sure. But also in terms of neo-paganism and including Wiccanism and elsewhere, if you've ever had this idea that what you're doing is has to do with a fertility goddess, probably that's under Fraser's shadow. This whole idea that primitive so-called goddess traditions were primarily around fertility, that he's really central to at least popularizing that account, if not more so. The idea some contemporary neo-pagans have of a god of the forest, the horned god, Cernunnos, etc. Although, of course, there are antecedents of that in that Fraser is riffing off of. But the idea that that was central, that there's a god and goddess figure, that they personify either vegetal deities or seasonal cycles in a particular way, particularly agricultural seasonal cycles, that's Fraser is heavily behind that. There's a recent book, an edited volume, Golden Bough 100 Years Later, something like that, where there are a couple of specific chapters in that that refer to the concrete influence of Fraser on Wiccan and neo-pagan movements. So that just came out, or not just came out, but came out after my book and before our conversation. But so it's directly there between Fraser and what will become Western esotericism. He really belongs. The Golden Bough belongs in the canon of Western esotericism, I would say. Yeah.
Great.
And then also we see his influence on Graves and the White Goddess, which is central to certain accounts of, you know, will be influenced on Wiccan traditions especially as well. So,
and is read as practically history by many sort of people looking back and trying to reconstruct a pre-patriarchal human era. It's like, it's basically just what Robert Graves says in The White Goddess. It's all true based on the slimmest of historical forays into the evidence.
Right.
Lovely stuff. Now, one last question I'd like to ask you.
Yeah.
The idea was raised to me that maybe we need to consider Fraser part of Western esotericism in a certain way. Now, that can mean nothing or something very interesting, depending on what we mean by Western esotericism and how we draw the boundaries and all that sort of stuff, which is all pretty much constructed by people talking about it rather than history itself. But this is why I think it's interesting. He is, as you say, looking for that deep structure. He's got this huge, massive evidence, right? It's all pretty much in books that he's got in his study. Yeah. And he's reading them and constantly taking notes. And by the time of the third edition, he's taken a whole lot of notes, right? Like 12 volumes yeah. worth. He's decoding all of this material. So it's the same instinct as a perennialist, perennial philosophy sort of person. Yeah. We see something very analogous at the same time in theosophy, right, going on.
Yeah.
But
that's
he
right.
isn't doing what a lot of theosophists are doing, which is kind of openly being oogly boogly about it, right? He's very much in a kind of, well, a priori either atheist or agnostic viewpoint. So he's not saying like, and maybe the spirits do exist, or maybe God is to be found behind all these different myths. Maybe that like the true divine reality is there. He's just not addressing those issues. But that in itself is something he has very much in common with 19th and early 20th century occultism more generally. The Crowleys, the Golden Dawns of the world, the Germans, they're not living in a religious thought world, but they're living in an enchanted thought world, nevertheless, you could say. Again, obviously, what do you mean by enchanted, blah, 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 but do you see what I mean? Like a sort of more or less atheist worldview, which nevertheless takes the idea of magic very seriously, which nevertheless, and here I think maybe Fraser, by saying what comes next after science, is really opening a window to the weird to enter into his whole worldview, as it were, from the future, right? Like the weird projecting yeah. itself back into history from the future. This notion that science definitely doesn't have all the answers. And the next thing is probably something we can't even imagine, right? There is a certain, I want to call it occultist, typically occultist with a capital O, impulse there in what he's doing, it seems to me. The decoding, the perennialism, but also the sort of opening to the weird.
Yeah, totally. And he's in dialogue. I mean, the other key figure from the period that he's arguing with is Andrew Lang.
Right.
And so, and Lang also had early an idea of a high god. Like he's also doing, they're both sifting through folklore, and they're both sifting through proto-anthropology, looking for a version of a Prisca Theologia or a perennial philosophy. But the difference is that Lang tended to imagine that behind all of this was at least in some versions of Lang, a primordial monotheism.
Right.
And indeed, that notion is, you know, we have a long history of that view.
For
you
sure.
know, going back to,
for sure.
you know.
In that sense, yeah. Fraser is much more 20th century, much more occultist rather than old school yeah. esotericist. He's not a Ficino. He's much closer to Crowley than he is to that older school, like
totally.
Within yeah. monotheism.
But I think you're exactly right. So Fraser then recoups not a primordial religion, but a primordial magic.
Right.
And a primordial magic that is detachable from religion, because he's very interested in reaffirming the analytical distinction between magic and religion. And so he's going to give us a portable magic that then you can then call yourself an occultist and be an atheist, or you could call yourself and do magic, or you could think of yourself as a Christian and also be doing magic, you know, occult. I mean, you could, it allowed a bifurcation there that recouped the power of magic, and that connected magic up to ancient traditions. So it's not magic as an ancient set of beliefs, but magic as an ancient set of practices, and practices that were at least initially efficacious or believed to be so. So then, you know, we're starting to get toward recouping a magic that does things, and he's telling you how to do it. You do, you know, similarity and sympathy, etc. There are magical rites that you can do, and things like sacrifice that then, you know, are being explained without reference to deities or other intervening entities. And I think you're also right, and I loved your gesture to the weird there, that he's in his, especially by the third edition, opening a possibility beyond science, and all, you know, and he's not dwelling on that. Like, he's not telling us what it is, and he's also not writing about science. He's obsessively writing about these different, what he thought of as primitive rituals. And then the other key piece of it, and this is also why he opens the world to occultism, he and other folklorists, is that they're seeing preserved in the so-called peasants or the rural peoples, these ancient traditions. And so that when, you know, Gerald Gardner or other people, people then think that they can recover what the witches were doing by talking to an old lady, you know, who lives in rural England somewhere. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And or, if you can't find one, you just make one up as you're kind of authenticating
apparatus.
And if you
can't find one, you make one up. Exactly. Yeah, totally. For all those reasons, I think he's, I mean, whether or not to define him as an esotericist or not is, again, a game of definitions. Yeah. But I think any serious historian of Western esotericism has to reckon with Frazier. Mm. Like, you can't understand that historical narrative. You will miss something significant by everything that comes after, especially 20th century traditions, if you don't realize that he's there. And he's offering something, you know, that will then continue to have influences in esoteric circles, even after he's been discredited in anthropological circles, and continues to have aesthetic repercussions in art and media down to the present day. Mm. So I would imagine, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, we could look whether the dude who did Midsommar was referencing Frazier or not, but we could,
maybe,
you know,
the point,
I wouldn't be surprised.
Maybe the point is also that Frazier is so in the drinking water now that you can make a movie like Midsommar and not have to reference him at all, not even know he existed.
Yeah.
You know, because he is the same way with Freud, right? He's seeped into discourse to the point where he's just certain presuppositions that people have about the way humans are come quite directly from these important authors.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. So it's in the, right. We've got it in our background.
Mm.
I would definitely say that the Golden Bough, should it be on the reading list of folks interested in the history of esotericism, full stop. And it's also weird. It's a fun read. Like, I wouldn't say don't try and blitz the full 12 volumes in one go, but do take on it. And I really do think the second and third editions are the ones to look at. The first edition's not quite as good, and don't read the abridgments, but take them, dip into them, check them out. There's all sorts of other interesting stuff. There are narratives about sovereignty. There are narratives about tangents around interesting sex practices. There are tangents that have to do with various repeated folk tales around death and outwitting death. I mean, just all sorts of fresh and interesting stuff that I think one can take inspiration from in, you know, artistic, like, there's a lot of room to draw stuff from the broader Golden Bough. Again, we'll reaffirm that it's basically discredited as anthropology, but it's fascinating, and it's a prime exemplary version of what we could call an intellectual imperialism or colonialism in its historical registers and in all the complex things that evokes, in that he thinks he has the interpretive key, and it's the interpretive key to the globe, and he's using the resources that were only made possible basically after British Empire, and he's writing in a period where that empire is still in place to analyze the rest of the globe, but he has interesting ambivalences.
Yeah.
The indigenous peoples are the ones who think in common sense way. The Christian churchgoers are not ones who think in common sense ways. And in a way, you know, he's worried about a return from below. He's worried about, you know, an outbreak of savagery among the peasants. But I read him as, especially later, hinting that some kind of rupture from above, from his class, the class to which he was assimilated, actually could be a good thing. That science needs to be transcended or at least religion in its Christian formulations needs to be escaped. So there are interesting resonances of that there in Frazier as well.
And the way that that is expressed sort of behind the scenes, he doesn't really lay it out, is a form of written esotericism, right? And it may be that he's writing for precisely the class to which he has assimilated, intellectuals who are capable of reading that information without it doing harm, first of all, because we can't have, presumably, the working masses of the empire realizing that Christianity is a myth or something like that, because it would lead to destruction and chaos. But those who are able to take that knowledge and truly understand it, some kind of elite that he's writing for, the message is there in the works, right? For those people.
Yeah, and I would say you're exactly right. In his letter to his publisher, as we know from the first edition, he wanted to be read between the lines. He was also someone who didn't like public controversy, so he would say snarky things in letters that he didn't necessarily say in public. But then the second thing, and you're exactly right about this too, one of his late works is something like A Devil's Bargain, A Plea for Superstition, where he plays the role of the devil arguing for superstition. And what his argument for superstition is in basically it keeps the masses in line, basically. Mm. So that's not the whole story. It's more nuanced than that. But one version of it is exactly that. So he does seem to suggest, yes, it would be good if the average, you know, working class person was still Christian and still invested in this particular version of morality. But wink, wink, nudge, nudge, there's something else, and read my text between the lines, rebuild an alternative to that Christian tradition. He was probably would have been shocked at the way that, that Crowley and others took that, but he left that opening for them precisely by encouraging an esoteric reading of his own works.
Jason Storm, it is fantastic to have this particular story of intellectual development and reception history on the scene of the Schwepp. It doesn't matter if you want to consider Fraser a member of the select coterie of Western esotericism or not. That's not really what we're doing, but this is an essential part of the intellectual history itself. So you cannot go wrong. Thanks again. Be like what comes after science and stay esoteric.
Thank you.